You are listening to a summary of All the Kremlin's Men, a book by Mikhail Zygar.
As Russia's role on the global stage grows more provocative, Russian journalist Mikhail Zygar weighs in with a no-holds-barred look at Vladimir Putin's leadership style. Zygar makes the compelling argument that to understand Putin, you must look at the crucial insiders who have helped shape his regime. Putin, the author posits, is a somewhat reluctant ruler, and partly a creation of his closest advisors. Though Zygar doesn't present an entirely airtight case for this claim, he offers ample evidence illustrating that there's no overarching endgame behind Putin's transgressions against human rights and international sensibilities. Instead, Zygar argues, Putin's leadership is characterized by a pattern of lashing out, time and again, against some real or perceived threat to Russia or to Putin himself. Viewed through this prism of score settling, Putin's actions begin to make a sort of strange sense. Though this book predates Moscow's meddling in the U.S. presidential elections, it can help readers imagine how such campaigns might bring Putin satisfaction. Zygar's account is overly intricate at times, bogged down as it is in Putin's ever-changing roster of consilieres, but the prose is stellar. Get Abstract believes this important book may be the closest thing to an insider's account of the Kremlin and its secretive ruler.
A strong man, but not one man. To outsiders, Russia is a nation controlled by one man and his clear agenda. Closer examination of Vladimir Putin reveals his rule as the result of a huge collective mind. Putin himself focuses on ascertaining how he can maintain his popularity. He has never fully trusted polling data and approval ratings and believes that his widespread popularity could vanish at any time. Meanwhile, dozens of men within Putin's inner circle work continuously to determine how their leader can keep his grasp on power. This shadowy brain trust deludes itself into thinking that logic and big-picture strategy underpin its decisions. In fact, Putin's and his advisors' moves are strictly tactical. Short-term responses to outside stimuli, including constant conflict and unceasing enmity from abroad. From this perspective, Putin's actions are a necessary and inevitable response to the threats posed by ruthless foes in Washington and the encroaching power of NATO. The rise and fall of Western alliances. When Putin became president of Russia in 2000, he immediately set about courting Western leaders. Putin entertained Tony Blair in St. Petersburg and Moscow. He also charmed George W. Bush with a tale about a fire at his dacha near St. Petersburg where the sole surviving item was a crucifix. The deeply religious Bush loved the story, famously saying of Putin, "I was able to get a sense of his soul." These Western alliances quickly fell by the wayside. However, Putin approved of Washington's 2001 invasion of Afghanistan. And he even agreed to let the United States establish a temporary air base in Kyrgyzstan. But Putin seethed when the United States decided it needed to turn the temporary air base into a permanent one. He became further disenchanted with Washington following the decision to go to war with Iraq. Russian spies and diplomats were far more familiar with Saddam Hussein than their American counterparts and rolled their eyes at claims by George Bush and Condoleezza Rice that Saddam had stockpiled weapons of mass destruction. Despite the conflict over America's war on terror, Putin retained a generally positive view of President Bush until the mid-2000s. In May 2005, Bush visited Georgia, where, to Putin's dismay, he contrasted that nation's new liberal values against those of Moscow. Putin was also astonished at Bush's response to the 2005 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, rather than recast blame or otherwise distract the electorate. Bush proved weak in Putin's estimation. This epiphany dramatically changed Putin's posture toward Washington. Germany's Angela Merkel was another leader Putin found he couldn't stomach. He felt she was excessively principled and took to intimidating her, knowing Merkel was terrified of dogs. Putin brought his large black Labrador to meetings. The more cynical Italian official Silvio Berlusconi was more to Putin's liking. Most Russians accepted Putin's early reforms, including his decision to close a number of former Soviet military bases. But in mid-2000, when Putin failed to cut short a vacation as Russian sailors fought for their lives on a sunken nuclear submarine, the Russian press pilloried him. This incident began Putin's long war against independent media, which he labeled manipulators of public opinion. As the decade progressed, Putin's views on NATO would also turn hostile. He seethed over NATO's expansion to Russia's very border, with no concessions or compromises, and increasingly embraced a vision of leadership that was far different from the prevailing view in the West. He also became more distrustful of U.S. interference in world affairs. When Venezuelan ruler Hugo Chavez blamed the United States for exposing him to radiation during a visit to the United Nations, for example, Putin believed the story. While Putin is partial to conspiracy theories that play up Western treachery, this line of thinking sometimes had roots in reality. For instance, in 2011, the U.S. Agency for International Development funded the non-governmental organization GOLOS, which monitored Russian elections. A fleeting moment of democracy. During Putin's first decade in office, consumerism heartily trumped politics. With Russia awash in oil revenues, ordinary Russians spent freely and oligarchs competed to show off their ever-growing riches. In time, Putin and his men realized that they too could use their power to grab wealth for themselves. Still, by 2012, many believed that Russia might be headed toward true democracy. Leading up to the 2012 election to succeed Dmitry Medvedev, Putin's opposition staged large rallies where chants like "Putin is a thief" proved popular. Putin responded with his own gatherings of supporters, many of them government employees. In a staged question-and-answer session with the Russian electorate, a factory foreman from the Urals told Putin that working men valued his skill at creating political stability and volunteered to keep anti-Putin demonstrators in order. Ever alert to shows of loyalty, Putin promoted the foreman to presidential envoy in the Urals Federal District, his thin political resume notwithstanding. The 2012 campaign marked a crucial turning point for Putin. He decided the middle classes and the intelligentsia were untrustworthy and unappreciative of the economic prosperity Putin had garnered them. Putin won 64% of the vote, easily vanquishing his foes. On the day of Putin's inauguration, security forces broke up a small rally staged by anti-Putin demonstrators. By the end of 2012, arrests and prosecutions of Putin's opponents had become routine. Opposition politician Alexei Navalny claims Putin simply acted in self-defense. Putin understood that had he shown any weakness, his own closest advisors would have turned on him. A campaign of demedvedization. Though Putin appointed Dmitry Medvedev to prime minister after his return to the presidency, he then embarked on a campaign of demedvedization that seemed designed to exact maximum humiliation. Working at a feverish pace, the Duma overturned Medvedev's more liberal policies, recriminalizing defamation and imposing tougher rules on political speech. Moscow's propaganda machine turned on Medvedev too. In August 2012, a slickly produced documentary titled The Lost Day appeared online, detailing Medvedev's missteps in Georgia. The film's tagline was, "How Medvedev's cowardice killed 1,000 people." Putin went on to purge the regime of those he believed were loyal to Medvedev and to enact laws which countered Medvedev's public stances on key issues. When Medvedev expressed skepticism about anti-homosexuality laws in December 2012, for example, the Duma passed a law limiting gay rights a month later. Loyalty above all. Putin has constructed a system in which his word is law. But under such a system, what happens if Putin isn't available to make the law? In December 2012, Putin was absent from the Kremlin for weeks as he secretly recovered from an injury. He told no one of his predicament. And Putin's top advisors were faced with a dilemma when the man who has the final say in everything is unreachable. What should they do? At first, the answer seemed simple: nothing. When the United States enacted new sanctions in December 2012, however, Putin's brain trust felt they must respond. Taking his cue from Putin's private comments, Vyacheslav Volodin, a deputy chief of staff, moved to bar Americans from adopting Russian children. Members of parliament pushed back, calling the ban a pointless provocation. But when Putin finally returned to his duties, he signed off on the adoption ban, a clear warning to any official who dared to think they could influence Putin's decision-making, and a win for Volodin, who had loyally supported his leader's anti-US sentiments. Loyalty has played a key role in the relationship between Putin and Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov. In 2004, Kadyrov, newly appointed to leadership, told Putin that he was prepared to give his life for the Russian leader. This abject loyalty pleased Putin, who granted Chechnya more than $600 million a year in rebuilding funds. William Burns, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, believed that a third of that money landed in Kadyrov's personal accounts. Putin also helped Kadyrov eliminate political rivals and critics. These assassinations were of little interest to most Russians, though the 2006 murder of the journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who investigated human rights violations by Kadyrov's regime, drew more attention. In response, Putin's media spun a grand conspiracy theory, claiming the murder was a Western plot. In 2014, Kadyrov again drew attention by assembling Chechen security forces in a stadium and urging them to swear fidelity as Putin's foot soldiers. Putin's relationship with Kadyrov began to crumble in 2015. However, when Kadyrov was implicated in the murder of Boris Nemtsov, an important Russian liberal opposition leader and former first deputy prime minister, the games we deserve. While the Sochi Olympics are widely associated with Putin, the original instigator was Vladimir Potanin, an oligarch and avid skier. When Potanin suggested the idea to Putin in 2005, Putin's response was tepid. So Potanin enlisted a deputy press secretary to help create an advertising campaign designed for an audience of one. Potanin placed billboards along routes Putin's motorcade traveled and bought airtime on radio stations he knew Putin enjoyed to push his slogan, "The Games We Deserve." The targeted campaign worked, and Putin agreed to pitch his favorite seaside retreat to the Olympic Committee, never mind that Sochi's subtropical location was less than ideal for snow sports. Once committed, Putin didn't hold back. Russian officials transported an ice rink to Guatemala, where the International Olympic Committee, IOC, was voting on the location of the 2012 Games. Putin personally charmed each IOC member in one-on-one meetings, telling them to bring their families to Moscow as his guests. Upon winning the bid, building began. The final cost for Sochi's Olympic facilities totaled more than $7 billion, due in large part to inefficient construction. For instance, it was only after Fisht Stadium was almost completed that designers realized the sea breezes were so stiff that athletes and attendees toting flags during the opening and closing ceremonies might be blown away. So the Russians added a roof at the last minute, creating a hefty cost overrun. From respected power to international laughingstock, Putin embraced Bashar al-Assad despite the Syrian leader's bloody response to rebellion. In a way, Putin and al-Assad were similar men, reluctant leaders who became anti-Western only after the rest of the world declined to show them respect. Putin wrote off Assad's attacks on his own people as a rational reaction to the Arab Spring, Indeed. He viewed the Arab Spring as a preview of a potential rebellion in Russia. Putin was, therefore, both perplexed and embarrassed when his support of Assad garnered him a cold shoulder at the G20 summit in Australia in November 2014. When world leaders posed for a photograph, US President Barack Obama and Chinese head Xi Jinping occupied the center of the stage. Putin was relegated to the periphery, next to South Africa's Jacob Zuma. This affront was followed by a low-priority seat for the Russian leader at lunch at the far end of the table from Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. The humiliation spurred Putin to leave the summit early. Wary of further poor treatment, Putin withdrew from appearances abroad. In this new era of Russian diplomacy, Russian state officials grew aloof. Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shuvalov appeared at the World Economic Forum in Davos for only one day and skipped most of the sessions. Perhaps the lowest point came during the Munich Security Conference, when attendees responded to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's claims that Russia's takeover of Crimea had followed the United Nations' tenet of the right to self-determination, with unbridled laughter. Russians were stunned that their official positions were received with such frank derision. If not Putin. During his first presidential term, Putin longed to step aside after his stint ended, or so the rumor goes. At the time, his brain trust employed considerable cajoling to keep him in place. Over the years, however, Putin's retirement from politics has become so unthinkable that the go-to chant at pro-government rallies, "If not Putin, then who?" seems more a statement than a question. As for Putin's advisors, the specter of Putin's retirement also carries personal repercussions. Many face Western sanctions and travel restrictions, and Putin serves as both protector and supplier of wealth. At the start of his political career, he did not see Russia beset by foes, nor did he plan to silence independent media, nor did he aspire to host the Winter Olympics. All of those things happened as the Kremlin's men tried to read Putin's mind and work to make their own wishes manifest.